You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flueckiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to the show, LA Talk Radio, Your Ultimate Life. Thank you for joining us tonight. This is a show dedicated to helping you create the life you want, a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy that you can create on your own with your gifts, with your talents, and your effort. I'm really excited tonight to have a guest coming to me in Florida, Dan Vega, who's a heavyweight, cool dude. I know him for, I don't know, a year or so almost, and really am glad to have you. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here. And when you say heavyweight, I'm hoping you mean for a while.
You know, I didn't even cross my mind heavyweight. So okay, you did that. All right. So I'm not going to like read a bio or an intro because I find that when people do that for me, it's kind of boring. So
yeah.
what I'd rather do is I'm going to ask you a weird question and we'll get started with that. Okay.
Sure.
And I want you to be not shy or not modest. So the question I want most often answered is, tell me how Dan adds good to the world.
So, yeah, I was just having a conversation with one of my people, and it's funny because, you know, I got started young, so I've been in, I've been having some success for quite some time. And she was asking me, what gets you out of bed? And as you know, Kellen, for quite some time, maybe 12 years, I've been running a mentorship program. We're all mentor about 20 people a year and put them through kind of a program. And then within a year, we'll hire them into one of our companies. And so despite deal closing and more this and more that, the most excited thing I'm, you know, really jazzed about, what gets me out of bed, is working with them and seeing the impact and the change in their lives. We're all about return on investment, but ROI has become return on impact.
Return on impact. I love that. So that's a very, very modest way of describing what you do. And I want you to think about 20 people a year. So 10 years, there's a couple hundred people. Yeah. And let's say only half of them, you know, sort of maintain the standard and growth and power that you lead them into. Can you imagine, like in their kids and kids' kids, how many zillions of people that's going to be that you have mentored, that you've allowed to learn to believe in themselves and to start creating results?
Yeah, you wonder about that ripple effect and how far it goes. I spent years, as you know, in the seminar business. So, you know, you're in front of large audiences as well, and, you know, all the other stuff that comes with that. But you wonder how far that actually goes and how deep the impact is. Because sometimes, and I know you've experienced this, you're sitting next to somebody and, you know, they're asking you questions and you give them some kind of off the cuff advice. To you, it's not profound. It's just like, here's what I would do. But at that moment in their life, they're just at that right place where they're finally ready. And you happen to be the guy in front of them that's going to help facilitate that change. And years later, they'll call me or they'll send me a book and they'll say, you probably don't even remember me, but you said something that was so profound. We were in the lounge or whatever. And I barely remember, but to them at that moment, you know, that was exactly what they needed to hear to put them on that new trajectory towards more success. Yeah.
So you say that, and I want to emphasize that for the audience, because that happened to me once. I was in a different career, long time stuff, and I went back to Phoenix in 2008, and I'd been down there years before. I'd left in 1995, so 13 years earlier, and I was in a singing group that happened to be very good and did a lot of cool stuff. But anyway, one day at one of the rehearsals, and they were large, like 300 people in this big choir, and somebody came up to me and I thought I recognized him, and he told me who he was, and he told me that very story. He says, you probably don't remember this, but we were in the same church congregation, and I had done something, gone to visit him once and told him something about his career. Don't do that. Do this. Go explore this, whatever. And he'd taken it to heart, and he'd gone there, and he'd had a whole career out of this thing, right? And I'm like, dang, wow. Who would have known? Right. So
yeah.
I love that. Tell me a story.
Yeah, this weekend I'm actually supposed to meet up with a guy named Sam Sky. I met him probably 15 years ago. I was in the seminar business. And after the seminar, we were in a lounge, and he pulls up a chair next to me, and he's telling me about how much he enjoyed everything, blah, blah, blah. But he was making a lot. I was asking him some simple, basic questions about his business and his career. he was making a lot of excuse. The economy is bad. It's not what it was. This is wrong. That's wrong. And I just said, look, man, I don't know you. I'm not trying to call you out. But since we've been sitting here for 30 minutes, you've made a lot of excuses. And, you know, successful people own, you know, their wins and their failures. And honestly, man, you got to. And I just gave him some nice counsel. I remember going through a few pieces with him. And I remember him, his body language, like he didn't know how to take it. He was a little bit like, okay, we were pleasant. He walked away, didn't hear anything about it. So about 4 years later, he writes me actually a letter. So I don't know how he got my physical address. He writes me a letter and he's like, you probably don't remember me, Sam Sky. And he goes, but we were after a seminar. We sat in the lounge and basically you called me out on my crap. And you were telling me I made a lot of excuses. And I actually remember sitting there. I don't remember what we spoke of, but I remember calling this person out because I remember it not maybe settling well with him. And I kind of wondered about it. And he goes, that changed my whole life. He goes, I went back. I didn't actually take it well for a couple of weeks. But then I just couldn't get over what you said. I thought about it and eventually revamped my entire business. I've made about $4 million over the last few years. I wrote up my first book. I gave you props and paid whatever. And so he sends me a copy of the book. And now it's been 15 years since the seminar. And for the first time, we're supposed to connect this Friday coming up in New Orleans for a live event. And we're going to share the stage.
Outrageous. Outrageous. So there's a story. What I always think is, people are wherever they are, right? They're in a sad place, and those stories don't get written too much. When people are successful and they make a conscious choice to be in service, to be, you know, doing good things, the interesting thing for me is the story about how they got there, how they got there. So you're in a place right now where you mentor a couple hundred people a year, and you mentioned you were in the seminar business, and you had success early, and you mentioned a bunch of things. Tell me a little bit of the story. How did you get to be Dan? Like, what is it in your journey that made you decide that being of service, that going out of your way, I mean, person can be successful and make money and do whatever, but you have this desire to serve and to do cool stuff. And so what is in your heart that makes that Dan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a thing where I'm good at mathematics. I really barely got through high school, but I've always had a high understanding of math. And because of that, it brought in great mentors early that were interested in kind of working with me and mentoring. And, you know, I had some great mentors and tried to listen twice as much as I spoke, which is difficult for me. And the fifth or sixth mentor, he was a guy that was one of the Forbes 400. He was number 25 on the list, worth several billion dollars. And, you know, I think sometimes success has a lot to do with timing. He had lost somebody in his family roughly my age. My father figure was, my childhood was not ideal. So we kind of filled this void for each other. And, you know, I remember sitting there watching him, and he knew everybody. He was, you know, he personally mentored Morgan Freeman and James Cameron, all the presidents. And I would tell him, I said, I know you're a rich guy, but how do you know all these people? And there was just such an adoration for this person. And what I really wanted to emulate, it wasn't the money or the career, the success. I wanted to learn as much as I could. But he was such a subservient leader. We would be eating and he would be like, are you done with this? And he would clear your plate. He would literally serve you. You know, he would always put his guests first. He always was putting himself last and just very humble. And I remember thinking, this guy's abilities and wealth, his abilities are off the chart, but his humility exceeds his ability. And that's something that I really wanted to emulate. And I remember a piece of advice that he gave me, because I was in my 20s, I'm grinding, I'm trying to push a ball up a hill like many of us. And he said, when you're trying to improve your, like when you're focus and your goal is to improve your situation, ironically, you never improve your situation. When your whole focus is to impart value to every single person you meet, you're going to really drastically improve your situation. And really, the more important thing is the impact that it's going to make on others. So I thought a lot about that because I was trying to improve my situation. I didn't have a good situation, but there was a shift there for me where it's like, okay, how do I impart value to every person I know? And there was some second guessing, you know, you're young and you might not have the confidence yet. So I tried to find little ways that I could at least display kindness or, you know, be a good subservient leader, putting the needs of others first. Sometimes it might be very simple in the beginning. And of course, as you know, the more success we have, the more resources and ability we have to help. But I think that was really kind of the shift for me and kind of the moment where my eyes were open. Because, you know, we hear all the time in our circles, Kellen, of the old Zig motto, or maybe it's, you know, Carnegie, they all say it, but if you help enough people become successful, you'll be successful. But that's almost still like an ask. It's like, what's the purpose though? If I help all these people, then I'll get mine. There's still something in it for you. But when you truly just give value to every person you meet and not actually worry about it, right, then I think that's when you really do some magical things.
So there's a big shift there. You've outlined something that's really, at least in my experience, is key, is critical, yet there's nowhere you get taught that. So you happen to be, you know, in the situation, you had a skill, it landed you in some circles to talk to people and had the opportunity to land with someone who did that thing. And you looked at it and said, I want to learn that thing. And so you went to work learning that thing and you found for yourself that that's true. We don't have a school for that. We don't have a class in university for that. And if you talk about that, that's, you know, serve first and don't work, not even with an ulterior motive, but don't worry about it. And people, yeah, but I'll go broke and die under a bridge. And, you know, you don't believe that, and neither do I. But how do we get that information? Because when I say, how do you add good to the world? Your mentorship is an intentional way to do that for 200 people that are under your wing. But there's 200 zillion. So where do we learn that? Like, why is that so missing in terms of how we help people succeed?
I mean, I'm sure both of us have our share of people that we're around, and they all say, you know, it's not about the money, just help people, you know, give value and you'll get yours. But then when it really comes down to it and you watch their actions, are they really living by, are they showing they really believe that, right? And I think it comes down to faith, really. And when I say faith, I think a lot of times we automatically, you know, attribute that to a religious context. But actually, the definition is the assured expectation of something not yet realized. So when you think about your success, whether it be in your career or your family or your marriage or whatever, that's what I'm doing is when I'm building a business, I'm like, I want it's the assured expectation of something that's not yet realized. I haven't fully accomplished my vision, but I know it's going to happen. And I don't have to have any kind of, you know, preconceived things and the ask attached to anything. And here's the way I kind of view it is I look at it like a mirror. So every single person that I meet, I'm going in with this mirror. This is a new relationship. And I say, you can't focus on two things equally, right? One thing will beat out the other. So am I going into this meeting with the mirror on me saying, like, what can I get out? Can I get another client? Can I get another this? Can I get another that? Or is it completely on them of really listening, really being present and saying, what does this person need? And how can I be of service and provide value? But you can't do both equally. And so going in, and I've had to correct myself sometimes where I find myself saying, oh, that I have a thing that he really needs and he could be a client. And then I got to go, no, get present, man. Listen to what this guy's, you know, what he's dealing with and what his needs are. And how can I just help potentially solve that problem for him? You know what I mean? Or at least point him in the right direction. But you're right. It's not taught. It's not very common anymore.
It's not. It isn't. And it's a critical skill. And the key, the linchpin of that switch is the existence or non-existence of an ulterior motive, an attachment to outcome and all that sort of thing. So how do you help someone? Like, you know, I'm a coach, mentor, that sort of thing. And one of the focuses I have is helping people to actually make that switch and to catch themselves. And I call it notice and choose, you know, notice what you're feeling and thinking about anything and then make a conscious choice. How do you help someone, the 200 people you're mentoring a year, which is an astounding accomplishment by itself, how do you help them see that? Is it just by example, watching you? Do you consciously teach it? And if you do, how?
Yeah, we teach it for sure. But I think what you just said is a real key, giving them a proximity advantage. And I do mentor people online, but most of the time for those 20, I do it locally in wherever I am proximity-wise, because I want them to not just learn a bunch of concepts and learn some business strategies. I want them to see the execution of it. And when they see how you treat others and how you, you know, put others first, and it lands different, you know, especially if you do have some success, they're like, man, it really, you know, changes things for them. So I think it is important to see the execution of those things. A bigger problem for me isn't the younger people that I mentor, but I deal with a lot of CEOs and a lot of, you know, successful business people and business owners. And usually they're so focused on profits, top line revenue, profits. And we're trying to get them to the other way of, hey, let's be good subservient leaders. And they have high integrity, but it's just not their focus. They're focused on profits as, you know, steering the ship, so to speak. And one of the ways that I'll help shift them is I'll call them out when it comes to their integrity. Because, you know, if you think about it, and this is kind of one of my pet peeves, I'll get on, you know, online, on Instagram or one of these other social platforms, and I'll see people constantly talking about the impact they're going to make and help others. And it's not about the money. It's just about helping people. But then when you look at their actions, they're not doing anything to really focus on getting good at the money side either. There's no balance there. It's one side or the other. And honestly, I don't ever think that the first objective should be about money or, you know, creating wealth. I think that there's a lot of other things that are more important, like maybe some would say faith, family, good health, you know, lots of other things. But I think that getting good at the finances would be it's not number one, but it certainly should be on the first hand of objectives, or at least in their definition of success. So when I see people talking about this, they're selling a narrative to their people, their online fans, their followers, their families, of this massive shift they're going to do, and they're going to make this huge impact and dent the world on a daily basis. But then I look at their actions, and there's really no action to get better at the money side. I think it's an integrity issue. And most of us understand the definition of integrity about, you know, being a man of your word, doing what you say, following through, having, you know, honor. But there's a different definition, which is to be structurally sound and congruent in all things. So if an engineer is looking at a building, he's saying, is this structurally sound? Is it congruent within itself? In other words, is it partially framed in, you know, wood, partially metal, partially recycled material? Can it withstand a storm? And so when I see people that are so focused on improving their situation, creating wealth, doing this and that, but then, or let's say the other, let's say helping people, but they're really not focused on the monetary side, it's not congruent. They're, you know, because if we don't figure out this piece out, we don't ever garner the appropriate resources to really help more than just a few friends and family. We can't fund a large impact, because if our goal is to impact, say, tens of thousands or millions, like, it's going to cost millions of dollars. So we have to create a sustainable model. So I find that it's interesting, this balance of sometimes I'm trying to get people to focus more on getting into congruency and falling, having better integrity, which would be, let's create some sustainable resources to fund this. And then half the time I'm talking to them about, you know, focusing on being others focused and being subservient leaders. And they really are dialed in on the money side. And it's like,
so that's a balance. You know, there's a question that I have, and I'd like your take on it. Yeah. I see people, I call them broke healers.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, they're people that want to change the world, and they're probably really good people, and they either don't like to talk about money, or they don't charge, or they don't know how, or they don't know how to close deals, or whatever. And I sometimes wonder if the narrative they're selling themselves about being of service and everything else is in some senses a camouflage for fear. Because I'm afraid I can't close deals. I'm afraid nobody's going to pay me. And if it comes right down to it, I can't do this anyway. What do you think about that?
I think for sure that almost every, and you mentioned healer, in a literal sense, every Reiki and energy worker and, you know, health guru kind of Eastern healer that I've ever met, I've met a lot of them, they got into that field generally because they had a crisis that they had to solve. they went down a rabbit hole and they figured out a solution. And they were so impacted by what they found, they felt compelled to share it with the world. So they were coming from that side of, you know, really making an impact, but never learned the other part. And I think that a lot of it is the fear of, you know, not being able to do that. I remember having a partner years ago, and he was so conversational. He loved people. He was such a good subservient leader. But we also have to make money, and I sent him on this. I set up like 10 people. It was in book publishing at the time. And 10 people that already had agreed to do a contract with us. Like, they already knew he's coming. He's bringing the contract. Just sign it and pick up a check, basically, right? And I sent him on this 3-week deal where he was going to go visit 10 and get them all. And he comes back and I go, hey, where's the contract? He goes, oh, he didn't sign not even one. And I go, well, what happened? He goes, Dan, I made such a bond with these people. They're so amazing human beings. They were just bringing up the money didn't feel right. Like, it didn't feel like it would have changed the dynamics of what I was trying to do. And I go, but they were expecting you to bring it up. I already talked to them about the money. So then I called all 10 people and I go, yeah, I thought it was weird that Adam didn't bring it up. Do you want me to send it to you? Like, it was just in his mind. They didn't have a problem. It was just him. But don't you think that a lot of people, and I think of artists, like in the music, or they're the rock stars, so to speak. They show up. They do the craft. They're the person that's the creative. Getting into the money, it changes the energy for them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's true, but I also think a lot of times maybe it should not be that person. They need to find a partner that really understands what that person's value is. Say, look, I know his value. I need to help him monetize it. Because he'll never do it. That's probably the key.
Yeah, I think that's both true. And I was just looking at, I did a social live today to a bunch of channels, and it was one of the topics was one of Stephen Pressfield's thing, about the resistance and that whole thing for artists. And he includes authors and artists and musicians and all that stuff. Anyway, well, that's fantastic. So what's your favorite project that you've worked on in 2024 in the context of sort of comprehensive success? It had a money side, it had an impact side, it had a thing that's like, yeah, I did this thing in 2024.
So back in 2006, I was in the seminar business, and I was doing really well. And when I came up, you know, in that field, I was a lot self-educated. So I was reading people at the time, like Brian Tracy and Zig Ziglar and Les Brown. Those were the guys on the block, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the time, eventually I'm sharing the stage with them and I'm making roughly what they are. And I'm like, I'm not sure how much farther I can take this. I mean, the impact was great, but I'm even thinking in terms of impact, not just finances. Like, how do I get a broader impact? And after one of the seminars one day, this university contacted me. They were like, we were at your show. We would love for you to coach us. To make a long story short, I started coaching them and I started looking under the hood. And on the finance side, they were making about $300 million a year. But on the impact side, I mean, forget audiences of a few hundred or 1,000 people. They had 90,000 students and over 180 alumni. And it was a massive impact. And I came away from that saying, that's probably the end all be all for me. I want to start a university. So I started one in 06. But unlike just traditional kind of education, I wanted to make it more entrepreneurship, kind of some of the things that we're speaking of as well, mindset and mechanics. And then, of course, once we kind of got into the digital age, it went online. But this year, I've been kind of, my focus has been split a little over the last few years with other projects. And the school does very well, but I haven't really put my focus on it. And it's a real passion for me. So 2024 is when I really started putting more focus on that personally. And not just the enrollments, we get a great amount of enrollment, but we created a school, brick and mortar school in Nairobi, Kenya, as well as we've given away about 50,000 scholarships as well, which is the part I really get jazzed about because, look, I believe everybody should have a shot. Right. And if they mess it up, hey, that might be on them, but everybody should have at least a chance. And that was what somebody did for me in terms of mentorship. And I want to remember that. So particularly for 24, I have to say that's probably been the project.
So in the beginning of the show, I said, how does Dan add good to the world? And you didn't mention a school in Africa and 50,000 scholarships of any size. That's tremendous. And you said, this is something that's really close to your heart. Tell me what it is. What is the feeling? I want to get a little squishy here. What is the feeling in your heart that makes that so important to give everyone a shot, to give tens of thousands of scholarships, to spend cash that somebody would buy another Mercedes with or a gold-plated Rolls to build a school? Like, what's going on in that heart?
So my Achilles heel has always been children, you know, people that just don't have a fair shake. And it extends more than that, but it's like when I see younger people, even youth, let's say 18, and they just don't have a fair shot in life, and they're at a massive disadvantage, circumstantially, because of maybe environment or whatever. I actually feel sick. I don't know why it affects me so much, but I can watch and hear things on the news or observe other things, and I feel like overwhelmed with it. Just really, really, it has always affected me. So, but I was watching, it's funny that you asked this question. I was watching a program about, I don't know, a few weeks back, and it was a famous Latin singer, the Latin Family, and she was a singer, and they became quite famous. And after a certain amount of years of success, she said, when I would take the stage, you know, and I'm in the moment doing it, it was absolutely amazing. Like, I was just, it was so amazing. But within an hour, I'm still backstage. There was no gratification. There was no, it was empty. Like, there was no real deep fulfillment. Like, in the moment, it was really cool. Man, I can't believe I get to do this. But there's no real gratification. There's no real, you know, purpose. And there's something that's very empty. It's not fulfilling. And so what does make me feel fulfilled is when I can see somebody, just even if it's not a big thing, you know, I help somebody, give them some advice to help with their credit, and I show them a strategy and they buy their first home, you know what I mean, and stuff like that. It really, really affects me. And I think that, you know, not to get into religion or anything, but I do think there is more happiness in giving than receiving. And when I was watching the show, I actually said to my wife, I said, that's exactly how I feel. When I'm on stage and I'm doing these other things, or I'm doing television or whatever, in the moment, I'm like, that was really rad. I love it. It was cool. But there's no lasting benefit to me, and there's no fulfillment. So the fulfillment part is what I'm now chasing, of like, how can I feel like I'm actually contributing something that matters? And you know this as well as I do, Colin, but when you travel, especially internationally to some countries, man, your life can get put into priority real quick. And we realize that 97% of the stuff we've read about is pretty meaningless stuff. There's maybe 5-6 things that are really important. Everything else is pretty trivial. And so I try to keep that balance and, you know, always have that, maintain that perspective.
So, Dan, I love that. And everything I do is about that, about lasting and real fulfillment. That's what your ultimate life is about. So here's a challenge for both of us. What do we need to do right now in this conversation? What can you share, since you're the man of the hour here? What can you share so that when you get done with this conversation, you don't feel like, oh, that was fun, and then it's over, but you feel like you said something or gave something here that would be lasting and valuable that you'll think about tonight or tomorrow? What is there that you can give for advice, examples, teaching, thinking, encouragement that's going to last more than 15 minutes after you're done?
I think two things, Colin, if you're open to it. So first,
of course,
you mentioned a bit ago, some people, but there's a fear there, right, that they might have to get over. And sometimes a lot of that fear stems from ourselves. We might have a fear of failure and maybe a low self-image. But one of the things I constantly think about, and I remember hearing the saying of, we can't consistently perform in a manner that is inconsistent with the way we see ourselves. And so sometimes the right answer when we're thinking about our career is, we got to go do work on us right now. Why am I feeling inferior? Why am I nervous to speak up or, you know, contribute value into certain conversations, or why am I intimidated by people that have money, or whatever that looks like. We need to identify that and think about, you know, we can't consistently perform in a manner that's inconsistent in the way we see ourselves. We got to change that image and kind of draw it on paper, a 2.0 version. And maybe it's like, this guy today, he's not good enough to accomplish this. And let's say $5 million a year, or do that or do this. But who could? Let me draw out a 2.0 version. What's that guy's habits like? What is his eating routine? What's his exercise routine? And then literally build something and then start following that advice. And eventually it becomes so, right? And the other thing I'll do, just because I'm so excited to be on this show, I've looked at several of your past episodes. And if you're willing, I would love to offer a gift, just because I do know your heart, Callan, and we have spent a little time together. You're such a giver, such a good example of subservient leadership and giving impact and value to everybody. That for the university, and just for listeners on the show, I'd be willing to give away 50 scholarships just on my dime, where there's no expense, for people, if they really want to change their life, they want to have a real impact. I'll waive everything and let them have some real access. And it won't cost them anything. Hopefully that will also add value that me and you have both created today.
That's fabulous and incredibly generous. And for listeners, we didn't talk about this ahead of time, and I wasn't even thinking anything. And this will do last beyond that. So, Dan, if somebody hears this and they say they'd like to participate in whatever you've just offered, a scholarship of some kind to the university, what does that look like? Where do they need to go? What do they need to do to have that happen?
Yeah, the best thing would be Dan at BLU, like blue without the E, Dan at blueuniversity.com. And we'll make sure that they have that. And all they have to do is mention that they were listening to LA Talk Radio, and we'll make sure they get that.
That's a fantastic thing. So Dan at blue, BLUuniversity.com. And mention that you saw this on LA Talk Radio, and 50 scholarships is an incredible thing. I haven't looked over the curriculum, so I'm not going to pretend that I have, but I know you, so I know the quality of the curriculum and can vouch for it without having seen it. That's a fantastic thing, and that certainly will last longer than 15 minutes after the show. So I really appreciate that. Yeah. So I ask about 2024, and now we're winding down. Like, we're already in December. And, you know, it's going to be Christmas and New Year's in 5 minutes. And then it's going to be 2025. And, well, that's how it feels when you get to my age. Every 5 minutes I say that, you know, 5 minutes ago, 10 years ago, 5 minutes. Yeah. All right. So 2025 is around the corner. And as you think about passion projects, like, you have many deals come. We've talked about different deals and, you know, business things that happen. And those are powerful. Not minimizing those in any way, because they create the resources for you to do things like give away 50 scholarships or those kinds of things. But if you think about your heart, that thing that we are built to do, because we really are built to love and serve, and I don't mind getting squishy about that. Our physical bodies are built to love and serve. We have cool neurotransmitters that happen when we do. So when you think about your passion projects for next year coming up, one that is either started or you're in the still incubation stage, I don't care. What is it? What are you doing? And tell me about it.
Well, I can think of a couple. One is really just more. So tell me if you have the same experience. So, you know, I go hard and fast all the time. And sometimes I'm working on so much stuff that I have to take a little bit of a break and work on something creative just to kind of empty my cup. You know, I'll try to get outside and get in nature, but a lot of times, if I can pour into maybe an hour a day of something that's very creative and very enjoyable to me, it does help me continue. And so about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I had an idea. This is so uncharacteristic of me.
What, having an idea is uncharacteristic?
Well, my wife would argue, yes.
I don't buy it.
Depends on
the idea. I don't buy it.
But I had this idea of writing a feature film. Mm-hmm. And I've never done anything like that before. I'm okay. I'm a decent writer, like nonfiction, but fiction and development of characters, not my thing. But I just had this great idea of like a scary, family-friendly kind of movie that's not all hack 'em up kind of stuff. So I wrote the movie and hired a couple of guys from Hollywood to convert it into a screenplay. And we were really getting traction about like getting this thing made. And then COVID shows up. And then after that, we had a writer strike, an actor strike. So finally, today's the 3rd. So it starts filming in 3 days on the set.
Oh, that's what Bailey was talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, because I was talking to him about doing something for me too. Anyway,
yeah, all right, keep going. And so for me, it's like I'm in the very last stage of the 3rd trimester. I'm like, oh my gosh, please, I want to have this thing already. It's a little bit stressful because I feel way out of my depth. I'm getting producers and directors calling me, and I'm like, I have a process in place of actually Bailey. If you need something, call Bailey. He'll make sure you have everything you need. Nope, they want to deal with me. Everybody just forget. They go straight to me. So it's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of stress there, but I'm really excited about the possibilities. So we'll have it shot this year. It'll go into editing, and then our hope is to premiere at Cannes Film Festival in France. In May is the trajectory. So that's just a passion thing that, you know, I've always been a movie buff coming from California, but this is kind of my first toe in the water kind of deal.
The listener, somebody that mentions a videographer and a producer and does all kinds of stuff, and I happen to know him because Dan and I were in an event together a little while ago, and that guy videoed it, and I have been talking to him about doing some stuff with my music. Yeah. But anyway, so I just did a WhatsApp back and forth with him. He said he was shooting something in right away, and I didn't know it was this. So there we go. And you said 3 days. I'm like, that must be that. Yeah. All right, cool. So that's fantastic. I just wish you the most awesomeness and best of that. So you have a family. Yep. You said you're married and you have how many kids?
One child, 17-year-old son.
17-year-old son. In your mind, ultimate life is about purpose, prosperity, and joy. And it isn't just about financial stuff. It's about meaning and purpose and having a meaning in your life and everything. Tell me about how important, for people that are watching this, talk about how important family and creating lasting and meaningful relationships is for Dan.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think I would have a fraction of what I would have without my family. It's something that I really rely on. And people that know us, they find this kind of odd because I think some couples, you know, let's say the husband's a business owner and then he comes home and shares everything. And I chose not to do that. So I'll go do all this stuff and I could have the greatest day ever or the worst. But I don't want to get into it when I get home and rehash the whole day and then add stress to them. That's just my personal choice. I want to downshift right into the family life and just be a dad and a husband. And so that's kind of the way we've always done it. I always kind of joke, like, my wife really doesn't even know what I do. She has an idea. But I'll come home and I just want to kind of, and this might sound odd because there's a lot of entrepreneurs right now that are very well known and have a lot of notoriety. And they're always saying, look, you got to be obsessed. If you want to be big time in business and make a lot of money, it's not like you can't just go to work. You got to be obsessed. And I don't want that. You know, even though I run several successful companies, when I leave work, I want to leave work at work. I don't want to be consumed by it. Now, when I walk through the doors, I'm all about work and I want to go hard and I want to do as well as I can. But when I leave, I want to leave it there and I'll pick it back up tomorrow. And I want to kind of get out of that headspace and go be a family. And I think having that separation for me has really, really been key. And another thing, you know, I remember when my son was 3, I was traveling a lot. I was doing 2 seminars a week, 45 weeks a year. And I thought, I can't be gone like this. You know, he's getting older now. So I got out of the, you know, full-time seminar business and worked on other projects. And I remember thinking, like, it wasn't uncommon for him at a very young age that if he wanted to learn how to play baseball, baseball players would come over the house and bring him a glove and pitch it, you know, or if he wanted to do this thing, you know, actors would stay at our home. And I remember telling my wife, we have to create normalcy. We have to live a certain way and live, you know, modestly, because you know, as well as I do, one of the things that really helps us is resistance and barriers. not good.
No.
And so I didn't want to have all that removed for him. I wanted him to come up with problems and resistance and barriers and think, Dad, here's what I'm dealing with. How do I overcome it? And have that personal power of being able to think through problems into solutions without everything being done for him. So we put in a lot of work of creating a very, very normal environment. And to us, you know, there's a certain amount we need, and we're fortunate to have more than we need. But other than that, you know, I don't think money is really the key to happiness. I think that having a great family life and having that balance in your life really is.
Not only is it not the key to happiness, but it can easily be the key to torture and misery.
No doubt.
So no question about that. You said something there that's really important, and I want to dig into it for a minute. And that is, there is the idea of grinding hard and, you know, having be all consuming. And that you've described a clear division where the exigencies or the pressure of business deals and work you don't bring home, and you create on purpose. You take the effort, which means it doesn't happen accidentally, yeah, to create a different environment. Talk for a minute about how to do that. So let's say somebody's listening right now that's grinding. They've created success financially, but they do bring it home, and it is consuming, and they're on call either actually or space rented in their head at all hours. And then say that, man, I'm hearing this dude that's successful. He's preaching from a different songbook. What would you help somebody with? How would you tell somebody to start on the road of creating the kind of balance that you're speaking about?
I think you just nailed it on the head when you said space rented in your head, because if somebody's working 40 or 50 hours, you know, there's a lot of people that are preaching right now, go 80, 90 hours or you're a wimp, you know, and that's what's necessary to be successful. I strongly disagree with that. But even let's say 40 or 50 hours, do you have more time to put into your career? Of course, we have 168 hours a week. If you're working 50, there's more time. But the question is, what you just mentioned, is how much headspace do we have? By all the crap we got to do in that 50 hours, and the things we got to keep track of, and the actions, the tasks we got to do in that 50, how much space is that renting in your head to hold all that stuff? And it could be another 50. So now we're completely, other than eating, sleeping, driving, maybe having one cup of coffee with our stuff, we're completely consumed. And the thing that you focus on the most is going to become the priority, right? It's going to, so that's kind of what we serve. And honestly, I just don't want to do it. So with the people that I mentor, I put a rule on them that they're not allowed to make their living more than 25 hours a week. They got to be able to make a very, very nice living within 25 hours or less, because the headspace that's still going to take as well. And, you know, we both know a lot of millionaires that maybe they have a net worth of a few million bucks. But when I look at their careers, there was no real strategy. They did that by grinding for 30 or 40 years, you know, tons of sacrifice, missing kids' soccer games, doing all this stuff. And then they had a house and they gained equity in their house, and maybe they inherited out. And then now after rent, they're millionaires. Like, there's no strategy to that. So I say, we got to learn efficiencies. We got to learn strategies that we can create real wealth within 25, 30 hours. And we can have the balance and, you know, the family and the kids and all that as well. And we just keep, so we have a fixed metric of like 25 hours is the living, that's it. And until you can solve that, we just keep working at it until we can make those two factors work. And for the people that are, you know, listening to this, you know, I've helped a lot of people create a lot of financial success, including millionaire status and way past that. And the first thing I have them do generally is cut their hours in half, because sometimes we're too busy to be successful. We do something that's 6 feet. Like, anybody can go out and make 100 or 200,000 a year themselves. Like, we can carry that brunt and go out there and make that happen. But that's going to be really hard. But nobody can make 10 million a year, 20 million a year without getting a lot of other people involved with your vision, right? You can't shoulder that kind of money. You got to get other people involved with your vision. And so I think that we get so busy pushing up the hill and focus on our own careers of the money that we can make ourselves, we're too busy to think about the money that other people can make us and the money that our money can make us, and especially the impact of it. And so by getting more headspace back and lowering our hours on our pursuit for our living, we can think about those more important things. And ironically, that will improve our situation, including financial.
That I want to repeat a little piece of that. And it's not because I don't think you listening have ears. It's not impossible. The idea that you have to work 60 or 80 hours a week in order to make your $200,000-$300,000 is not true. It is a myth that has been created. I'm not even going to speculate, but it is a common misconception. If you maximize the gifts and skills that you have, which is all what your ultimate life's about, if you maximize those, you can make a comfortable living in the 25 hours Dan's talking about. And so I just wanted to repeat that because it is such a divergence from common wisdom and from what people talk about. Now, we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to ask you another question. I want to say, so we've talked about a bunch of things, about family, about money, about what it is and what it isn't, and all kinds of stuff. What didn't I ask you about that you think you should leave here with this audience?
That's an interesting question. What didn't we discuss? Well, I'll tell you one thing. So I get asked questions a lot of like, what's the one takeaway? Give us a nugget for success, whether it be financial or personal. What's a nugget? And I know you know this. We've had this conversation actually. But one of the things that I think that we most people get wrong is separating our vision from our strategy. So I think that most people at one time or another in their life, they have a great vision of something they want to do, not just big vision, you know, in terms of finances, but impact, something they really want to go big on in the world. And they have this vision, and we want to make sure that with that vision, that we want to lock it. We want to make it fixed. We want to write down how big is it? What color is it? How does it make people feel? How does it help them get on a new trajectory towards a better life? We don't have to have the how we're going to do it, but we have to be able to see what that looks like in as much detail as possible. And then we lock that down and we get that fixed. Now we walk over here and we start our initial strategies to try to accomplish the vision. And what most people do is they don't separate those two, the vision and the strategy. And so they start their first iteration of the strategy. And of course, we know it's going to roll, let's say a car, it's going to roll 4 or 5 feet and the wheels are going to come off. And they're going to get so discouraged about the vision. They're like, oh my God, I thought this was going to work. I really thought this was the one. And then it's like, then they might put it back together and say, I'll try one. They roll it, goes 11 feet and it falls apart. They're like, oh man. And what they do is they start second guessing the vision. Is this still going to work? Then they'll likely go to the people they know and say, hey, man, am I crazy? Should I be? And they're going to say, yeah, you're totally crazy. You need to get a real job.
Right.
And so then they're discouraged and they're out. So what I know from factual history and not only my history, but it's been documented so many times, is that when you have a great vision, you don't have to have all the how you're going to do it, but get as many details as possible of what you want to happen and lock it down, draw it out on paper, make it fit. Then you start your strategy and it's always on the fifth or sixth refinement and iteration of the strategy that the strategy actually accomplishes the vision. It's never going to, when you launch a strategy, it's never going to accomplish the vision. It's going to fall apart, and then you're going to be able to have data collection and say, okay, what happened here? Put the car back together, roll it again. On the fifth or sixth refinement of the strategy, then it accomplishes the vision. And going into a big vision and launching a strategy, thinking the strategy is actually going to fully work and facilitate, that's naive thinking. It's on the fifth or sixth iteration that it works. So my whole thing is get to that fifth or sixth iteration as possible and don't discourage. And I've launched some stuff, Kellen, and you probably have too, where when I launched it, it was horrible disaster. And my people were like, Dan, this is horrible. It's not going to, I go, I know, right? My vision is awesome. My strategy blows. I need a new strategy. But I don't discourage. And if those listening, you can look at the 7-Up story. 7-Up started as 1-Up soda. We want to 1-Up the competition. And then there was a second, third, fourth, fifth. At 6 iterations, the guy's like, I'm out. I'm not doing this no more. I'm selling everything. And the guy that bought it says, can I also have the data and the research you had? He makes one iteration becomes a massive success and then sells to Coca-Cola. So most people give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And I'm sure we've both seen that over our careers many times. And so just think about, like, just because the strategy is failing, it doesn't mean you don't have the right thing. It doesn't mean it's not going to work. We just haven't done those 5 or 6 iterations yet. And we got to really enjoy and get into the, you know, loving the process of data collection.
Fall in love with the process. So, Dan, if people want to find out more about you or read something or follow a little more, I know that there's blueuniversity.com. Where else can people find you?
Yeah, any of the social. I'm not real active on social media, but LinkedIn probably is a good place to find me. And I do check it. And especially if they say, I saw you on LA Talk Radio. I will respond and engage for sure. But if you don't put that, I'm out.
All right. Hey, Dan, I want to thank you for taking time. That is appreciate it. I know your schedule. I know what you're doing, and at least some of it. And I want to express gratitude for you taking time to be with us tonight. Thanks.
Hey, my pleasure. And by the way, I got to tell you, I picked up some of your books, and I'm really gleaning a ton of value. So thank you so much for everything you do.
I'd love for you, not right now, but later, to tell me what books you have and tell me what that's about. Love to know.
Have me back on.
Go ahead. Say it again.
I said, have me back on. We can make a whole show about it.
All right, buddy. Thanks for being here. We'll see you.
Okay. Thank you.
Listeners, I want to tell you to listen really good. Dan's an incredible guy. He's done amazing stuff, and you'll be richly rewarded for mining all the good stuff that he gave you as you move forward to create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.